Right. The recorder's working. Okay, so this is Bio 241. It's February 2nd, and this is the last lecture on chemistry. We're talking about this phospholipid molecule, and I wanted to know where do you find the hydrophobic region, right? And it's these fatty acids right here, right? Fatty acid number one on the first position and second position bound to the center part of the molecule. What's the center part of the molecule? You should be able to recognize that. It has three carbons. Yeah, that's glycerol. Glycerol is a building block of a triglyceride, but glycerol is also a building block of a phospholipid. Okay, that's where substitutions can be made. So how would you take glycerol and add a fatty acid to it? What kind of reaction would you use? Dehydration synthesis reaction. And if you want to break this molecule down, what kind of reaction would you use? A hydrolysis reaction, right? And water participates. Don't forget about that. All right, so here is the hydrophobic region. Here is the hydrophilic region of the molecule right here because of the phosphate group and this nitrogen group right here. You can see have electrical charges on them, so that means it can form hydration shells with water. And also because of this OH group can ionize, and then you're left with another electrical charge right here, so this will attract the positive end of a water molecule. You should know what end of a water molecule is a little bit positive compared to the rest. Right. As a matter of fact, somebody should probably tell me, what's the more positive end of the water molecule? Yeah, the hydrogen atom, right? And what's another way of talking about a hydrogen ion, for instance? What's a hydrogen ion? It's just a plain old proton, right? It's just the nucleus of the hydrogen atom that lost its electron. And so it's just a proton sitting right there. And you can see that on the periodic table. All right, so we said that when we put this molecule in a salad dressing bottle, right, it's going to orient itself. It's going to form a membrane right at the meniscus between the water layer and the lipid layer, and it's just kind of magical the way that happens. It's not really magic. It's just physical chemistry, right, but it happens automatically. All right, and if we take a bunch of these molecules, phospholipid molecules, and put it in a bottle that only has water in it, right, then this molecule does something even more interesting. All right, so what do we got right here? A phospholipid molecule. Now, instead of being a flat layer lining up within the meniscus between the oil and water layer, there is no oil layer in this particular example, just what? What do we have in this bottle? Water, and you see the water molecule right here. Okay, so then the phospholipids will actually form kind of a all-enclosing or self-enclosed membrane. It will just self-assemble just like that. And what does that kind of remind you of? Not just a membrane, but now it actually looks like a cell. Okay, so that is really kind of fascinating. It's not really a cell because it doesn't have cytoplasm, but certainly you can see that this is a beginning step to cell formation. And this thing is what we call a micelle. And so the hydrophilic part of the molecule is going to be facing water, and the hydrophobic tails of the phospholipid molecule will be pointing to the inside of this sphere. So a micelle is really a sphere, not a circle, right? And then the physical chemistry of this molecule is kind of satisfied. Okay, so that's a nice phospholipid molecule. There's a couple other examples of lipids that we have. These are steroid compounds. And these are all hydrocarbons that you see in here. I don't see any functional groups. I only see one hydroxyl group over here. All right, so this molecule really does not like to dissolve in water because it's just hydrocarbons. And this is what cholesterol is. All right, and cholesterol, is cholesterol good or bad for you? It's both. Yeah, you guys are getting pretty smart. All right, if it's in the right quantity, it's really good because cholesterol is the precursor molecule to cortisol. That's an important hormone in your body. It's also an important precursor to testosterone. That's a male sex steroid, right? No, and actually, men nor women want to be without testosterone in their body, okay? And it's also the precursor molecule to estrogen. This example is estradiol. All right, so you have to have cholesterol in your body as a precursor to synthesize these very important hormones and other important hormones inside your body. But if there's too much cholesterol, then that can cause cardiovascular disease. That can cause degeneration of blood vessels and plaques to form in blood vessels. So the proper amount is what you should have. Now, I do want you to be able to recognize this general form as being a lipid, and in particular cholesterol. Right? You don't have to memorize this molecule, but how do you recognize this compared to a fatty acid? Remember, fatty acids were just long and linear. This thing right here kind of looks like a staircase. You see a step right here and a step right here. I see some ring structures. So I would want you to know that if I show you something like this, it's going to be a hormone, and in particular what we call a steroid, some kind of steroid. So cortisol is an example of a steroid. Testosterone is an example of a steroid. Estrogen is an example, specific example of a steroid. And where do all these steroid hormones come from? Cholesterol right here. That's the basic building block molecule for making all of these steroid hormones. So do you see that staircase that I'm talking about right here? Made of these like little blocks, these rings right here. All right, so these are steroids. So what kind, where do steroids fit into the scheme of biological molecules? Are they carbohydrate, lipid, protein, or nucleic acid? They're a lipid, right? So that's something important for you to know. Okay, prostaglandins are also important signaling compounds or hormones inside your body. And if we take a long fatty acid, all right, so here is a functional group. Anybody know the name of this functional group over here? That's a carboxyl group or carboxylic group, right? And it's an acid group as well. I'll just kind of mention that right now. But here is just a long fatty acid that's been modified to form this hairpin bend in it. So it's not just long and linear, but it's long and bent right here. These things are prostaglandins. So these are important signaling compounds in your body as well. All right, so they serve many regulatory functions. And depending on where the functional groups are located within this modified fatty acid, then it's a different kind of prostaglandin. Some of these prostaglandins can be excitatory, some can be inhibitory to various kinds of reactions in your body. It's a very diverse group of hormones. So if you see a nice hairpin bend in an otherwise lipid molecule right here, you're going to consider that a prostaglandin, right? You're not going to call this thing a steroid. Why wouldn't you call this a steroid? Okay, because you don't see that staircase effect of this molecule, right? It's like a hairpin bend. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much it for lipids. I guess we could review. What kind of reaction would you make? What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Glycerol, one glycerol, and three fatty acids, right? And how would you make a triglyceride from those building blocks? Yeah, you could say condensation or dehydration synthesis reaction. Or sometimes it's just you just think of it as a dehydration reaction, but I like to say dehydration synthesis because it helps you remember what's going on. And if you have a triglyceride and your body wants to break it down into the building blocks, what kind of reaction would your body use? Hydrolysis reaction. And besides glycerol and three fatty acids, there's another important molecule that participates in a dehydration synthesis or a hydrolysis reaction. And what's that other important molecule? Okay, it is H2O, water molecule, okay? Water molecule. And what is really interesting about that? Because water participates in many chemical reactions in your body, but it's also the solvent that our body is dissolved in. All right, so not only can you consider water a solvent, but it's also kind of like an important metabolite because it participates in these chemical reactions. All right, I did see a question up over here someplace. You still have your question?
I was just curious, as far as micelle
goes. Oh, let's go back, yeah? Yeah, it's kind of flipped back and forth. Flip, flop. Okay. And that's because, let's go back one more slide. So here is the hydrophilic part right here. And if we look at that hydrophilic part, sometimes we see a negative charge and sometimes we see a more positive charge. All right. So the negative end of the water molecule is going to be more associated over here, and the hydrogen end is going to be more associated over here. And I think that was just an artist's rendition of how it's just kind of a random arrangement. Okay? So this hydrophilic part will actually attract both the oxygen end and the proton end of the water molecule. They'll kind of sneak in there. Okay, they'll kind of sneak in there together. But that structure isn't really supposed to show anything in particular. Okay, as a matter of fact, here I see two water molecules right next to each other with the same orientation, but pretty much everywhere else it just kind of flip-flops back and forth. Okay, so there's no specific orientation right there. It's just the thing that you should really realize is that the hydrophilic end of the molecule will attract water, and these hydrophobic tails will shun water. They'll try to get away from water. Okay, that's the most important thing. All right, so then we got what? Steroid hormones, prostaglandins. All right, now we're ready for proteins. That's the third kind of biological molecule that we're interested in, so let's take a look at some of these. And probably before you took this class, you knew what the building block of a protein was. Or most people did anyway, I would guess. You probably heard one way or the other. And what's the basic building block? Amino acid. All right, so here on this slide, the very top picture, this is an example of a general amino acid. And guess why we call this an amino acid? Because here I see a carbon, and bound to one end of the carbon, we have a carboxyl group. And in reality, what is a carboxyl group? It's an acid, right? So the acid and amino acid comes from this carboxyl group right here. And then if we look on the other side of this carbon atom, we see an amino group. All right, so since you have an amino group and an acid group right here, we call that an amino acid. Just as simple as that. And all amino acids are very similar. All amino acids will have an amino group and a carboxyl group and a hydrogen bound to this central carbon. This central carbon sometimes we call an alpha carbon, but it's just a central carbon. And then we see a nice covalent bond coming up off the top to an R. And if you look for R in the periodic table, I don't think you're going to find it, okay? So that R doesn't stand for a particular chemical. It means that any kind of functional group can be substituted into this position where you see that R. So one of maybe 20 or 25 different kinds of chemical compounds can be bound covalently to this carbon. And when the functional groups are different, then the amino acid is a different kind of amino acid. And sometimes that substitution on the alpha carbon right here, sometimes they're nonpolar compounds, like I see a CH3 and a CH3 and a CH right here. This is a nonpolar group, right? That's just a hydrocarbon. You don't see any positive charges or negative charges, no polarity. So this part of the amino acid won't want to have anything to do with water, right? It wants to be more associated with the lipid environment inside your body or the nonpolar. Here's another example, tyrosine, that has this aromatic ring coming off, and again, this is a nonpolar group, even though it has one hydroxyl group right here. This is still nonpolar. And this is also interesting, this tyrosine, is because your body can make valine by itself, right? But your body cannot make tyrosine. People don't have the enzyme anymore to deal with this fancy aromatic ring right here. All right, so in our diet, we have to consume tyrosine in order to make proteins that need this amino acid to produce the function of whatever that protein is. All right? And the only kind of food that has all of the amino acids, what we call essential amino acids, like tyrosine right here, is an animal protein, okay, not a plant protein. So if you eat plants, or if you're a vegetarian and you don't pay really close attention to your diet, you might be devoid of tyrosine or some other essential amino acids, and then your body can't make some proteins, and you'll lose the function of whatever that protein is. And as a matter of fact, some neurotransmitters, all right, are built from tyrosine. The way that cells, neurons communicate to each other are modified forms of tyrosine, so if you don't have tyrosine in your diet, then you'll lose brain function as a result of that as well. Okay, but there are people that are successful vegetarians, and that's because they have learned, maybe through their culture, they've learned through their heritage, or they read books, how to combine various plant proteins so that they get all of the amino acids together. Like, for instance, if you eat beans and rice together, you get them all. But if you just eat rice, you don't get them all. If you just eat beans, you don't get them all. All right, so you have to be a little bit careful with that. All right, so an essential amino acid is an amino acid that you can't make in your body and you need a dietary source for it in order to be healthy. All right, another class of some amino acids are polar amino acids. All right, and here are some right here. Notice I did mention the names. Okay, like valine and tyrosine, arginine, cytosine. You don't have to know the names of these amino acids. I just want you to see that there is a lot of variability within amino acids because we can put different substitutions or different functional groups on this position of the alpha carbon. Okay, some are basic. So here is a basic group because of this nitrogen. And this right here, this is sort of an interesting group, right? It's called cysteine. It has a sulfur, and it's covalently bound to this hydrogen. So what can you tell me about this end of the water molecule? Is it polar or nonpolar? It's polar because, remember, polar covalent bonds form with this hydrogen right here if it's what? Phosphorus? Nitrogen? Sulfur and oxygen, right? So you should know those four. So this end likes to associate with other polar groups and not nonpolar groups. So this group wouldn't want to associate up over here, all right? And then here we have aspartic acid that has a carboxyl group right here, so that means that it's an acid. It's a double acid, okay? And this one right here, this is glycine. This is the simplest amino acid. So if you put an H where the R is, that's going to be glycine. I don't want you to know the names of these things, but if you see a structure that looks like this, come on, cursor, if you see a structure that just looks like this with a carboxyl group and an amino group and an alpha carbon right here, you should know that to be an amino acid and not a steroid, right? And not a carbohydrate, but an amino acid. And you can see that really clearly because here's the carboxyl group, here is the amino group. All right, and just like for triglycerides, and just like for polysaccharides, your body can put different amino acids together to make a protein. Okay, so what kind of chemical reaction would your body use to make a protein? A dehydration synthesis reaction, just like for lipids and just like for carbohydrates, right? So here's an amino acid. You see the carboxyl group and the amino group right here, and we're not paying attention to this functional group right here. That's not so important for the discussion. But if we put these amino acids together, just like this, we see what can form. Water can come out, and that will form a nice bond right here between this carbon and this nitrogen. And that's a nice strong bond. As a matter of fact, we call it a peptide bond. It's stronger than the usual kind of covalent bond, even though it's just sharing one pair of electrons. This is a nice stable bond, right? So I still see 1, 2, 3, 4 amino acids that have been joined together, forming 3 peptide bonds. So what else forms with this dehydration synthesis reaction? If you form 3 peptide bonds right here, 3 waters have to come out, right? And then if you want to break this protein down into its amino acids, what kind of reaction would your body use? A hydrolysis reaction, and you would need 3 water molecules to break these 3 bonds. But that's kind of a tough proposition to do, right? And you need very strong, very strange, extreme environments in pH to break these chemical bonds, like, for instance, in your stomach. Does anybody remember what the pH of gastric juice is from your anatomy class? Yeah, it's 2. It's even close to 1. It's high, it's very acidic. So under very acidic conditions, some of these peptide bonds can be broken. And then in the small intestine, other peptide bonds can be broken in extremes of pH, but going the other way, very basic pHs, okay? Like maybe 10 or so can break some of these peptide bonds. So that's why your digestive tract is so extreme in terms of pH, to break some of these peptide bonds right here. All right, so just like a polysaccharide is a polymer, okay, and what the heck is a polymer? It's a molecule. It's a big molecule that has what? Repeating units, repeating building blocks over and over and over again, put together pretty much in the same way. All right, like starch is a polymer, and the repeating unit, what is the repeating basic unit or building block of starch? That's glucose, right? And so starch is just a polymer of glucose. And a protein is a polymer made of what? Amino acids that we see right here. Okay. So let's talk about some different kinds of proteins. If you have a polymer with less than 100 amino acids, we call that a polypeptide. If it's greater than 100 amino acids, sometimes we actually call that a protein. And some hormones are very small. They only maybe have 8 amino acids in them, so we don't really consider them a protein. They're considered a polypeptide, really short sequence hormones. All right, so let's talk about structure. And why the heck are we interested in structure of a protein? Because it's going to directly relate to its function. That's right, that's right. All right, so there's something called primary structure. There's something called secondary and then tertiary and quaternary structure of a protein. So we're going to become familiar with these things. All right, so that we saw that there are numerous amino acids, 20 very common amino acids, right? And in this particular example right here, we see 3 amino acids. Here's one here, here's one here, and here's one here, right? And depending on the R group, these amino acids could be all the same or they all could be different. Okay, so if we know the order of amino acids in a protein or a polypeptide, we say we know the primary structure. The primary structure is just the order or the names of the amino acids that make up that particular kind of polypeptide. So this could be glycine, glycine, glycine. That would be the primary structure, just a linear sequence of amino acids. So it's like the spelling, using different letters to spell a word. You could use different amino acids to spell out a particular protein, okay, and a polypeptide then would be the word, and the amino acids would be the letters that make up that word. And if you change the order of amino acids that make up that peptide, then what about the word? Does it change? Yeah, the meaning of the word changes, right? Or the function of the protein changes. Okay. All right, so here we have the linear sequence of amino acids in this polypeptide right here. And it doesn't remain just a nice linear thread. It has a tendency, depending on how the polypeptide is spelled or how the amino acids are put together in sequence, it can form different structures. This thing right here kind of reminds me maybe of a spiral staircase. We call it an alpha helix. So this is a helical kind of protein, right? And we call this the secondary structure. So it's not just a straight linear line of amino acids. It's a coil of amino acids. So this is what the primary structure is. There can be another this is the secondary structure of a protein. There could be another secondary structure that's called a beta-pleated sheet, depending on how the amino acids or what amino acids are put together in sequence. Instead of a nice coil like that, another common secondary structure is what we call a beta-pleated sheet. And it kind of just looks like an accordion. It has sharp folds in, right, the sequence of amino acids right here, but that is still secondary structure of a protein, right? And so let's make this a really big protein with over 100 amino acids. So we just chopped off just a little piece right here, all right? And then there is a tertiary structure. Tertiary structure, we see an alpha helix right here. We might see some other regions that might have an alpha helix or beta pleated sheet. And then there's some hairpin turns and bends within the molecule. The tertiary structure is really the three-dimensional shape of the protein. Right? And the tertiary structure is determined by what? What's the building block of the tertiary structure? Is the secondary structure. So this protein can only form when you have an alpha helix in this region right here and other amino acids in the proper sequence to form this little bend or this little loop right here. So the tertiary structure is dependent on the secondary structure. Okay, and the secondary structure, can we go back? Yeah, and the secondary structure is determined by what? The primary structure. You got to have the right sequence of amino acids to form this thing. So think of the building block of secondary structure is primary structure, and the building block of tertiary structure is the secondary structure. All right, so this protein can't form unless you get this alpha helix right here. All right, and this is not a very stable molecule, because what's holding this together in most cases, or mostly, will be the weakest kind of chemical bond. What was the weakest kind of chemical bond that we looked at so far? Hydrogen bonds, right? So hydrogen bonds, maybe on this slide right here, I can see some hydrogen bonds. See this little dotted line right here? That represents a hydrogen bond between this amino acid and then an amino acid later on down the line in primary structure. All right, so these are really weak bonds holding this alpha helix together. And the same thing for this beta pleated sheet. There will be hydrogen bonds between different amino acids that kind of stabilize the structure right here. All right, so that's a very weak kind of bond. Okay, and so this protein can change shape pretty easily if the environmental conditions change. All right, and it can, and when it changes form, it means that it can't go back to its original shape. All right, so if you heat this molecule up, it's going to start bouncing around and twisting and bending, and then all of a sudden something is going to snap because the hydrogen bonds are really weak. The structure of this tertiary structure is going to change. And when we change the tertiary structure from its native configuration that we see right here to a non-native configuration, if we change the structure of this protein, guess what changes? The function of the protein is going to change. So let's say it's an enzyme. As it sits right here, it's going to catalyze a chemical reaction. The reaction can take place, but if we heat this enzyme up right here past 37 degrees, it's going to change its shape. What's going to happen to that chemical reaction? It's going to stop because then this protein no longer has that catalytic ability to make that reaction take place. There's something else that happens, right? If we change the shape of this protein right here, we change the tertiary structure, we change the shape, not only does the function stop, but this protein can never get back to its original shape. In that case, we say it has been denatured, right? So denaturation is a irreversible process. Once you denature a protein, it can't go back to its native conformation or native configuration. And you're really familiar with that, okay? Because, for instance, if you have a shrimp or a piece of chicken or steak or hamburger, okay, get some raw hamburger out of the refrigerator, do you eat it raw like that? Raise your hand. Most people don't, at least in the United States. It's a real delicacy in some parts of the world, okay? But what do you like to do with raw hamburger or steak or chicken or shrimp? You put it on the barbecue, right, and you cook it. And what can you tell me about the protein, right, as you're cooking it? Does it look different compared to when it was raw? Sure, because it's being denatured. The shape of all those proteins are changing, all right? So, okay, so let's pretend I'm making a nice hamburger on the barbecue tonight, and I got it out of the refrigerator and it was raw, so I cooked it. I'm ready to sit down and eat it, but I got a phone call. I pick it up and it's some of my friends that say, oh, you know what? We have three people shooting pool. We need a fourth person on the table to shoot some pool. Come and join us right now. I said, well, I can't because I just made this hamburger, okay? Now, what am I going to do? Am I going to sit down and eat my hamburger or am I going to go shoot pool? Well, for sure, I'm not going to let my friends down, right? I'm not going to waste the hamburger either. I can put it back in the refrigerator, right? So now I got a nice warm hamburger and I put it in the refrigerator, and what happens to the hamburger? It cools back down, but does it ever get to be raw hamburger? Do I have to cook it over again? No. Okay, so what we did when we cooked that hamburger is we denatured those proteins. They'll never go back to the way they were before it was cooked, right? All right, so that's denaturation. That's irreversible. You change the native conformation of that protein. But you could cook food, right, in other ways. How else can you cook food besides with heat? So cooking food is a way of preserving it and also making it easier to eat. You get actually more nutritional value if you cook foods properly. But some people know other ways to cook food besides heating it. What are some other ways? With acid. Okay, what kind of food do you cook with acid? Like ceviche, fish, and sauerbraten, where you take like a brisket of meat, beef, and soak it in acetic acid or vinegar, right? That's another way of cooking and preserving it. That's another delicacy, right? Or you can cook by changing the salt concentration, right? By making it a very salty solution. That's another way of denaturing food and preserving it and making it more digestible, easily digestible food, all right? So pH, temperature, salt concentration can denature these proteins because it will change the conformation of this protein. All right, so we got primary structure, secondary, and tertiary structure. There is a fourth kind, but before we get the fourth kind, let's look at this protein that we have right here. All right, so these are all amino acids, right? Hundreds of amino acids that are making this long protein. And because of the functional groups on the alpha carbon, here I see a carboxyl group that's ionized. Here is an amino group that's been ionized. What can you tell me about this negative charge on the carboxyl group from this amino acid over here, and way down over here at some distant location, this positive charge on this nitrogen group on a different amino acid later on in the protein? What can you tell me about these two charges right here? They will attract each other, right, because they're opposite, and this is a nice ionic bond. So that's a little bit stronger than a hydrogen bond, so this bond will stabilize the protein to a greater degree. Right, and over here we have an example of a hydrogen bond between these two OHs right here. So this is really easy to denature this bond because that's a weak bond. And then here is the fourth kind of chemical bond that we haven't talked about yet. And this is by far the weakest. Here we have an amino acid with a nonpolar group. Here's another amino acid with a nonpolar group. And these nonpolar groups like to associate, because they're devoid of charge. They have no polarity whatsoever. They don't want to be around water, just like all those hydrophobic tails on the phospholipid that make a micelle. These two different functional groups like to associate because they're nonpolar. Right, so these will be attracted to each other very weakly, associating these parts of the protein. We call these van der Waals forces. All right, so make sure that you can write down in a list the four kinds of chemical bonds, which is the strongest and which is the weakest. All right, so which is the weakest kind of bond? Van der Waals forces between just neighboring nonpolar groups. They will have a tendency to associate. And as a matter of fact, let me see if I can do this without making everybody dizzy. Yeah, I think I can. Okay, so what is stabilizing the internal structure of this micelle right here? Actually, they're van der Waals forces, right, because these are all nonpolar regions of the molecule that come together, right, and they sort of get glued together, though that's the weakest kind of bond that's holding anything together, right? So van der Waals forces in here, holding those phospholipids together. All right, now the strongest was a covalent bond, right? And here is a region of the protein that's held very tightly together. There's a strong bond holding this part of the protein to this part over here because there's an amino acid that has an SH group, and that's the sulfhydryl group, that's cysteine. So there's a cysteine amino acid here and a cysteine amino acid right here, which has a sulfur on it. And these sulfurs can come together, and it can release hydrogen atoms. That hydrogen will come off. So here is a nice disulfide bond. It's a covalent bond. These are difficult bonds to break. So even if you cook a protein, these bonds maybe don't break very often, okay, but so many other kinds of bonds break that proteins get denatured. And a lot of people are familiar with these, especially beauticians, because guess what kind of bond makes hair curly or wavy or kinky curly or something like that? It is these disulfide bonds right here between different proteins in a strand of hair that will cause it to coil, right, or wave or kink or whatever. And you can actually take cysteine molecules that are in hair and form these disulfide bridges with some chemistry. If you go to a beautician, right, they can give you what's called a permanent, right? And it doesn't last forever, but a really long time probably, right? And if you get a permanent, that is a way of denaturing your hair proteins. And I think a beautician can even take a permanent out of your hair if you know how to do that. But it's a relatively rough chemical kind of treatment because it's dealing with these disulfide bonds. And that's the only example where if you denature a protein, you can renature it, you can get it back to its original condition, is when you get a permanent taken out of your hair. Okay. If anybody has another example of reversing a denatured protein, I'd like to hear it. But that's the only example that I know of that's that doesn't follow the rule, okay, when you take a permanent out of your hair, breaks these covalent bonds. All right, so here we see what the nice tertiary structure. We see these bonds that stabilize tertiary structure, right, that can form this kind of protein right here. All right, the last thing, quaternary structure. Some proteins perform their function because they're not just one strand of protein, but multiple strands of proteins come together, and they can fit together, right? So here, that's what we call quaternary structure. So here is a molecule called hemoglobin, and it is actually made up of four different protein strands. And the reason why they fit together is because they just have the right shape, right? Like your hand will fit in the glove if the glove has got all the five fingers to it, right? And it's the right shape. You don't want to put the left-hand glove on the right hand, that kind of thing, for instance. It just won't fit just right. So if the tertiary structure is proper, then different strands of proteins can come together to form a bigger molecule that's pretty stable, and it's stabilized, again, mostly by hydrogen bonds between these different protein strands. So this is what we call the quaternary structure of a protein. Okay, and again, this thing can be denatured with pH or temperature or things like that. All right, so what's the building block? Let's go back to this one. What's the building block of quaternary structure? What allows these four different kinds of protein strands to fit together? What's the building block? Yeah, the tertiary structure. And what builds the tertiary structure? The secondary structure, and the secondary structure is based on the primary structure. So if we change the primary structure of this protein right here, eventually what will happen? The quaternary structure will change, right? First the secondary structure is going to change, then the tertiary structure, and then the quaternary structure can't change. And that's the basis of mutations for some kinds of disease processes. And for instance, there is a form of hemoglobin that protects against malaria. It's called hemoglobin S, and it's the result of a change in one amino acid in this big protein right here, and it changes the shape of hemoglobin, and it helps protect people from malaria. Unfortunately, that modification also changes the shape of this hemoglobin molecule right here. Okay, makes it a lot longer. And does anybody know where hemoglobin is found? Inside red blood cells, which is in your blood, right? So red blood cells carry oxygen. This molecule carries oxygen because it has a pigment inside of it. It's called iron. So an oxygen molecule will bind right here and here and here and here. So every hemoglobin can bind four oxygens, transporting it in your body. All right, but if there's a mutation right here, then it causes the red blood cells to change their shape because red blood cells are just loaded with hemoglobin. So instead of being, anybody know what the shape of a red blood cell normally is? Nice and round and smooth. Okay, but if there's hemoglobin S under certain conditions, the red blood cell changes shape from nice and round and smooth, which can flow through blood vessels very nicely. It changes into a sickle shape with pointy ends. And then it gets stuck in blood vessels, and it blocks blood vessels up, and blood can't get to the brain or to the retina or your heart or to muscles when they're exercising. And so we call that sickle cell anemia, and that's actually a terrible disease to have. Okay, so those people are protected from malaria. It's just it's been selected by evolution because it does protect those people sometimes. But in general, it produces very terrible symptoms, which you're familiar with. Okay, and so let's consider an exercising muscle, and we cut off blood supply to it. Whenever you contract a muscle, like these forearms right here, or biceps. Oh, you can't see that biceps, but it's really big and bulging right there, and it's hard as a rock. Okay, it's turned into this rock, so blood can't get into it, right? And you've had that happen to you. You ever walking down the street and all of a sudden you get a cramp in a muscle, maybe in your leg or stomach or whatever. And let's just pretend I get a cramp in this bicep. So am I going to walk around and say, wow, everybody, look at that. Really impressive biceps. I'm really proud of this thing right here. Or what are you doing when you get a cramp in a muscle? You're doing anything to get that cramp to go away, right? Because why? It hurts like hell, right? And that's because blood isn't getting to it. It's producing a lot of lactic acid, and the pH is changing rapidly in that muscle, so it hurts like hell. So somebody in sickle cell crisis, guess how they feel all over their body? They feel like that all over their body. It hurts like hell, okay? So they need special kinds of treatment. And so what do we do for somebody that's in that kind of extreme pain? Okay, well, first opiates. Okay, to get the pain erased from their body, right? And so when you're going through your clinical life, just remember that some people are drug seekers, and maybe they're a little bit dangerous because you never know what they're going to do for drugs, but there's another class of patients that need that kind of medication just to be normal, All right, so you got to treat them with a lot of respect and make sure they get the proper treatment for the disease process that they have, right? Okay, and then after that, after you control their pain, then of course blood transfusions almost at the same time so that they have the proper kinds of red blood cells so that their muscles and retina, kidney, and heart, brain don't die as a result of it. Okay, so that's a really kind of interesting disease. And you can see that the structure of the protein plays a big role in how it functions. All right, other proteins are joined with other groups. That's what we mean by conjugated. A protein can be conjugated with other kinds of groups. For instance, like a sugar molecule, that's going to form a glycoprotein or a mucopolysaccharide. It's part protein and part sugar. Lipoproteins are kinds of proteins that have been conjugated with a lipid molecule, okay? Maybe a fatty acid, or maybe a cholesterol, or some kind of steroid. All right, others like hemoglobin that we just looked at are conjugated with a pigment, like that iron molecule that allows it to bind oxygen so that hemoglobin can carry oxygen. And a pigment is just some kind of chemical that has color to it. All right, so iron, when it's bound with oxygen, produces a color, and you all know what that color is. What color is? It's red, right? Okay, so a pigment is just something that absorbs some kinds of the wavelengths that are in light, but not all of the wavelengths in light. So if you have all of the colors in light, what color do you see? If you have all the possible colors presented to you, what do you see? You see white. But if there is a pigment, if there's a chemical compound that absorbs blue and green, okay, and yellow, but not red, what color does it look like? It looks like red because it's reflecting red back to your eyes, okay? Like these chairs right here kind of look yellow to me. So that's the wavelength that they're not absorbing. They're absorbing like blue and red and all those other colors so that it looks yellow to you. Okay, so that's basically what a pigment is. And light is a form of energy, okay? And sometimes, and light is electromagnetic radiation. Sometimes electromagnetic radiation is very harmful to our bodies. It causes mutations. And so we have pigments in other parts of our body, like our skin. And some people have more of that kind of pigment that you learned about. That's a natural sunscreen. You learned about it in anatomy. What is that pigment in your skin? Melanin that absorbs those harmful wavelengths from the sun, mostly ultraviolet light, which we can't see with our eyes, but it's there. Okay, so this table right here just shows some proteins that are found in the body, and it tells you how many polypeptide chains make them up. Well, here's insulin. It's got two chains. Does it have a non-protein component? Insulin doesn't. Okay, and some functions as well. So you can kind of look that over for some interesting information. All right, that takes us to nucleic acids. Nucleic acids is the last biological compound that we're going to look at. And the building block is not a monosaccharide, okay? And the building block is not an amino acid, and it's not a fatty acid. It is a nucleotide. Nucleotide has three parts to it. It does have a 5-carbon sugar. How many carbons are in glucose? Can you remember? 6? Yeah, you're going to learn that really soon. That will roll off the tip of your tongue pretty quickly. All right, but this one is not a 6-carbon sugar. It's a 5-carbon sugar. It's going to be either a ribose or a deoxyribose. What is the 5-carbon sugar deoxyribose missing compared to regular ribose? The hint is in the name. Deoxy means it's just missing an oxygen atom, right? So it's exactly the same 5-carbon sugar, just missing an oxygen atom. So here's the 5-carbon sugar. On one end, we have a phosphate group, okay? And on the other end, we have a basic organic chemical, and it contains nitrogen. So sometimes we call that a nitrogenous base, kind of a big word for just a basic molecule that has some nitrogen in it. All right, so this is a nucleotide. There are two kinds of nucleic acids. There's DNA and RNA. RNA is just ribonucleic acid, and DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid. So deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, has this 5-carbon sugar that's missing one of the oxygens in one of the positions. So DNA and RNA are very similar. The only difference is that oxygen, and in some cases, the base changes as well. Okay. So these are the three parts that make up a nucleotide. And nucleotides can be put together to form a polymer. What kind of reaction would you use in your body? Or what does your body use to take the building blocks of a nucleic acid, okay, and put them together? A dehydration synthesis reaction, right? Really nice. How would your body take apart a nucleotide like this polymer right here? How would it take it apart? With a hydrolysis reaction, right? So again, water participates in that chemical reaction. In DNA specifically, these are the names of the bases. There's guanine and thymine, cytosine and adenine. And these circles or ovals right here just are supposed to signify that these different molecules, some are big, like guanine and adenine, and then thymine and cytosine are kind of small, right? Which means that's going to determine how this molecule can fit together, which we're going to see. All right, so here is a strand of DNA, and the backbone of this strand is an alternating phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, all right? That just is the alternating, kind of like the handrail that makes up this strand of DNA. And then sticking out to the side is always going to be the nitrogenous base, right? And it's either going to be, and I'm going to always abbreviate it, GC and AT, right? But you should know what T stands for. Okay. And I don't want you to know which ones are purines and which ones are pyrimidines, but these are the nitrogenous bases right here. Okay, the big ones are the purines, the little ones are the pyrimidines. All right, so I'm just trying to have you see that there's a difference in size or shape of these bases right here, which has some important meaning for the function of how these groups work. Okay, and in DNA, this 5-carbon sugar is always going to be deoxyribose. All right, so let's go to the next slide. Do we have another slide? Ah, we do. Okay, well, DNA does not like to exist as a single strand. It likes to exist as a double strand. All right, so here is going to be one strand of DNA, and then there's going to be a complementary strand on the other side. They're going to join together to form a structure that kind of looks like a ladder. Right, so these strands are going to come together just like this. So we see phosphate sugar on this side, and then a phosphate sugar on this side. And the rungs of the ladder are the nitrogenous bases. The handrails are what? The sugar and phosphate molecules. Okay. Well, if we have a large nitrogenous base on the right, the only way that this stepladder can form is if we have a small nitrogenous base on the other side. This thing won't form if there's two large nitrogenous bases. The other thing that's interesting is that the number of hydrogen bonds has to match up. So guanine can make these three hydrogen bonds as well as cytosine right here. Right, so this forms a nice bond between these two strands of DNA. And adenine only has two. So adenine can't pair, even though it can pair with something small like cytosine. It won't pair up because it doesn't have three hydrogen bonds right here. Okay, so the size and number of hydrogen bonds determines that guanine will always pair up with cytosine. And only cytosine. And adenine will always and only pair up with thymine in DNA. That's just the way it goes, right? Just by the shape and structure and the formation of these hydrogen bonds. So we call this the base pair rules for DNA, right? Adenine always pairs with thymine, guanine always with cytosine. The other thing that this slide shows right here is that DNA exists as how many strands? One, two, or three, or four, or what? As two strands, that's right. Right, two strands. And if we have thymine over here, what's on the other side? Adenine, always adenine, okay, because of the base pairs. So DNA forms what we call a double helix, which we see right here. It's not just a straight stepladder, but it twists and turns. And the interesting thing about this molecule is that the order of nucleotides in a strand of DNA is the dictionary on how to build a protein. The sequence of nucleotides in DNA determines the primary structure of a protein, which I don't think we get to in this chapter. We're going to maybe go to another chapter to look that over. But there is a correspondence between the linear sequence of nucleotides in DNA and how amino acids are put together. All right, so that's a very important dictionary for how you spell a protein. Okay, so DNA is always a double strand. Here are some nucleic acids, or at least the sugar in nucleic acid. Here is deoxyribose. It has five carbons, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And in this position right here, the normal ribose sugar would have an oxygen. But if we look at it right here, you see that it is missing an oxygen just at this one location. All right, and that is really the biggest difference between DNA and RNA. So if we look at the five-carbon sugar over here, which we find in ribose, here is that oxygen atom, okay, in this position. All right, so does that look like a big change between RNA and DNA to you? If I were to look at this, I'm not sure, especially if I had like a 730 lab like I do for anatomy, I'm not sure I would see the difference between these two molecules just by looking at this one oxygen here and one oxygen right here. All right, so what does this tell us? A small change in shape can do what? Make a huge change in the function of molecules, right? So that's really the big difference between DNA and RNA, just because of the deoxyribose versus ribose right here. The other change is, okay, and again, it's relatively small. In DNA, we have thymine, and what does thymine base pair with? Adenine, right? That's just the base pair rule. But in RNA, we never find any thymines. We use a compound called uracil, or your body uses uracil. And you can see that they're structurally similar. They're both small molecules, right? So in RNA, uracil will base pair with adenine, okay? So that would be one way that we could look at the difference between RNA and DNA. The building blocks are basically the same, except one uses a deoxyribose, right? And then the thymine is substituted for uracil. Okay, the other difference between RNA and DNA is that RNA is single-stranded. Now, it can bend. It can form hairpin loops and coils and things like that. And there can be short segments where that same strand, when it bends back on each other, can base pair up according to the rules. All right, so the rules would be, what, GC and in RNA, AU. Come on, cursor. Anybody see my cursor? Here it is. AU, because there's no thymine in RNA. All right, so there can be base pairing for short segments of an RNA molecule, but generally I think it's best for you to memorize DNA as being double-stranded and RNA as being single-stranded. But that is not to say that DNA, okay, is always stuck together. All right, so here we see, now would this be RNA or DNA right here? DNA, because it's double-stranded, that's easy to see, but there's also what? Thymine right here. Okay, so double-stranded, and I see thymine, so this is a nice DNA molecule. In order to get at the spelling on how you want to build a protein or the sequence of these nitrogenous bases in DNA, the molecule has to come apart. It's got to unzip, okay, to be able to look at what the spelling is right here. In order to know you got C, G, T, G right here, the molecule has to unzip. All right, and what's the beauty of this molecule? Can it unzip easily? Yeah, because why? It only has hydrogen bonds holding the strands together. So this molecule unzips, and the sequence is read out right here, okay? And then after that sequence is understood and read out, what happens to the molecule? Zips back up, and it doesn't require a whole lot of energy to do that because it's only hydrogen bonds holding those two strands of DNA together. All right, so if they were covalent bonds, then it'd be very difficult, be very costly in terms of energy to unzip the molecule and zip it back together again. Okay, way too much cost in terms of ATP to do that. Okay, so RNA generally is single-stranded. DNA will be single-stranded only when the sequence of the DNA is being read out. Okay, and that's what we call transcription. We're going to look at some of those processes a little bit later in the class. All right, so think of this as a ladder. The handrails are the sugar phosphate from the nucleotides, and the steps are the bases that pair up according to their size, all right, but also the number of hydrogen bonds between them. So I want to ask you, which ones are purines or pyrimidines, which ones are big ones or small ones, or the number of hydrogen bonds, but you should at least understand that the shape of these things and the bonding pattern is important for zipping together two strands of DNA. Okay. All right, so what does RNA make? RNA is a copy of the DNA that you have inside the nucleus, and it's a kind of copy that can be put into the cytoplasm, and if it gets destroyed, it's no big deal because the cell always has that information in the DNA inside the nucleus, which is protected. All right, so RNA is made, and there's basically three different kinds of RNA. This is a good basic place to start. And this RNA then is used to direct protein synthesis inside the cell. So let's start on the bottom right here, ribosomal RNA. From anatomy, you probably have an idea of what a ribosome looks like. Is it a big organelle like the nucleus or a teeny tiny one? It's a teeny tiny one. It's really hard to see, even with an electron microscope. Right? You can't really see it with a light microscope. It's the workbench where proteins are made. All right, so it's like this tabletop right here, and it's got to have amino acids, and it's got some has to have some energy and machinery to join amino acids together. Okay, what kind of bond is formed again when amino acids are put together? It's called a peptide bond, right? So it's a covalent bond, a really strong bond. And amino acids are put together. And what kind of reaction was that? That's a dehydration synthesis reaction, right? On the ribosome. So the ribosome is the workbench that gets amino acid, puts them together, all right, and then it gets some more amino acids, puts them together to make a protein. All right, how does it get amino acids? Because there's a little taxi RNA running around the cell, and it can find a particular amino acid and bring it to the ribosome so the ribosome can join it to a growing protein. We don't really call it a taxi RNA. It's close. It's called transfer RNA. So sometimes it's abbreviated little t and then big RNA, capital RNA. So the job of the transfer RNA is to bring the raw materials or the building blocks of a protein together, right, at a ribosome. So the ribosome can actually make the protein. The third kind of RNA is messenger RNA. And the messenger RNA is a big, long molecule, and it contains the spelling or the order of amino acids that have to be put together in the right order or the primary sequence of a protein. So it's like the dictionary for how to make a protein. If a protein is a word, messenger RNA is the dictionary that tells you how to spell that particular protein, what amino acid has to be in the first position, what's the name of the amino acid that has to be in the second position, right? What's the name of the amino acid that goes in the third position, all the way to the end. So that's what the messenger RNA is. All right, so these are the three kinds, and what you can see with an electron microscope really is only this ribosomal RNA when it's put together with some proteins to make a ribosome. All right, so that's it for chemistry. Well, we got a couple seconds left in class. All right, so I don't want you to leave just yet because we have some special fun. It's on. Oh, the clicker doesn't work. This clicker does work. All right, this is in Blackboard someplace. You have to mouse around for it. Let's look at documents. All right. Okay, so some of you might be familiar with these little fun things that we do. We did this in anatomy a couple times for different tissues and bones and various kinds of things. But this is going to kind of help you with some chemistry so that you recognize some of these molecules. So what you see right here is just kind of a square. This is a rest station because sometimes you have to work really hard when you look at these diagrams. All right, so if I show you this right here on a test, what would you call this thing? Okay, it's a building block for RNA. So this is what we call a ribonucleotide. Here is the ribose sugar. Remember, this is not the deoxyribose because there's the oxygen. And then here's the phosphate group, right? So here's the ribose, and then here's the nitrogenous base. I don't want you to know which one this is, but you should know this is a ribonucleotide because it's a basic building block of RNA. Okay, do these arrows work? Oh, good. All right, well, we worked pretty hard, so what's this? Rest station. All right, Now, what's this? What do you see highlighted? Sulfhydryl group, right? Sulfhydryl group right there, which makes, that can join with another cysteine, for instance, amino acid to form a disulfide bridge, which really stabilizes proteins. All right, so when we change the structure of this hydrocarbon backbone right here, then we can change what? The function of it as well. All right, so that was pretty hard. But so we got to rest. But then what do we got right here? Amino group. What can your body do with this amino group? It can make amino acid, right? Which then your body can make proteins. Because this, you need this to make a peptide bond. Okay? All right. And what do we got here? Carboxyl group. This is an acid group, but it could also, it's also necessary to make a peptide bond, right? Okay. So carboxyl group, what's this right here? Phosphate group, right? So I do want you to recognize all these things. Where would you have a phosphate group? And a phospholipid, for instance, right? To make that end of the lipid molecule hydrophilic, to give it its magic kinds of properties. Okay. And don't forget, sign in sheet is going around. What the heck is this thing? I don't want you to know the specific name. I want you to know the general name of this. First, is it a lipid? No. Is it a protein? No. Carbohydrate. It's a sugar. But what kind? It is a monosaccharide. Right? So monosaccharide, I see six carbons right here. So it's a six-carbon sugar. And it likes to form this ring structure. So I would say monosaccharide when I see that. What about this thing right here? Fatty acid, right? Carboxyl group, this is the fatty end of the molecule. Here is the acid end. But now what kind of fatty acid? Is that saturated or unsaturated? Unsaturated fatty acid. That's a really good term. Unsaturated fatty acid. Okay, what's this right here? Rest station. Ooh, tell me first, what's happening here? Then we'll analyze the pieces. What's happening? Look at the arrow. It's a dehydration synthesis reaction because it's producing two waters. What is this molecule here? Glycerol. And what are these three molecules? They all look the same. Three fatty acids, and then they go to make a triglyceride. So it shows you the building blocks of a triglyceride. If you go the other way, what is it? What reaction is it if you go the other way? Hydrolysis reaction. What's this? It's a six carbon sugar. So it's a monosaccharide. But it has a little bit different shape because of this functional group right here. That's just a fructose molecule. But I want you to know that's a monosaccharide. What can you make out of a monosaccharide? A disaccharide or polysaccharide. And how would you do that? Dehydration synthesis reaction. What do we got right here? That's a micelle. And these are all phospholipids right here. What are the bonds that stabilize the internal part of a micelle? Van der Waals forces. What are the bonds that stabilize this outer wall of a micelle? Okay, hydrogen bonds. Hydrogen bonds. Nonetheless, both are very weak, but it forms. Okay, what kind of molecule is this? Steroid. And what kind of molecule is a steroid? It's a lipid. The more general name is lipid. And, right, these are hormones down here, and this is the basic form of cholesterol, which is a lipid. Are these things hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Hydrophobic. They don't like to dissolve in water. Ooh, that was a lot of work. Okay, next one. We get to do a couple more. What's this? Unsaturated fatty acid because of these double bonds right here. Okay. Oh, what's this? Amino acid. Right? And that's a building block for proteins. What is this molecule? Phospholipid, all right? See the hydrophilic end here and the hydrophobic end over there? So I do want you to recognize that. Even if it's upside down, what are these? Prostaglandins, they're modified fatty acids, so they have a bend in them. They're important hormones. Ooh, what's this right here? Okay, all right, yeah. So different ways you can think about it. It's an alpha helix, but it's also what? Secondary structure. What's it the building block for? Tertiary structure, and what determines what's the building block of a secondary structure? The primary structure of a protein, right? Oh, what's this right here? It's a nucleotide, okay, but it's missing oxygen, so what is it? A deoxy, right? Ribonucleotide, deoxy. All right, what's that? Okay, you could say hydroxyl group, alcohol hydroxyl group. Okay, where are we? Oh, what molecule is that? That's glycerol. You can take a glucose, chop it in half, you get something really close to that. What is that? What's this right here? That's a carbonyl group. Carbonyl. And then what's this? That is the ribonucleotide, because it has, so this is what makes RNA, because it has that oxygen. All right. Okay, let's do like maybe three or four more. What's that? Sulfhydryl. What's that? Amino. What's that? Carboxyl. And that? Phosphate. Well, that's four. That was pretty quick. What's that? Monosaccharide. Okay. So maybe next time we'll start with that really fast. Sign-in sheet is going around someplace. And have a nice weekend.
All right.
Very good. Very good. Okay.